Thank you for tuning in to CITR 101.9 FM. You're listening to Democracy Watch, the News Collective's weekly news report, bringing you alternative and undercovered current affairs from Vancouver and the Lower Mainland. My name is Alex DeBoer.
I'm Christina Song.
And I'm Lyndon Wong.
It's Thursday, November 22nd at 5:02 p.m. We're broadcasting from UBC's Vancouver campus on the ancestral, traditional, and unceded territories of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people.
On today's show, you're going to hear from Urban Issues reporter Christopher Chung. Christopher is a graduate of the UBC School of Journalism and a reporter for the Tyee. Last week, Chris broke down which demographics make up Metro Vancouver's low, middle, and high-income neighborhoods by ethnicity, education, and immigration status using data from our 2016 census. And you might not be surprised to learn that there has been an increase in division and inequality over the last few decades.
After that, we're turning our attention to proportional representation. As everyone knows, British Columbians have until November 30th to mail in their ballots to determine whether or not our province will keep its current first-past-the-post electoral system or move to one of three types of proportional representation.
We're going to start out with context on the PR referendum from Andrew Watson of Election BC, then turn to perspectives from both pro and anti-PR representatives. Our segments on PR include by addressing the myth that proportional representation leads to a rise in radical fringe parties.
Yes. So before we get into all that PR fun, we are going to go to our interview with Christopher Chung on division and inequality in Vancouver by neighborhood to do with Vancouver's shrinking middle class. So let's go to that now. Hi there, my name's Alex DeBoer. Thanks for listening. Last year, Professor David Holkansky of the University of Toronto mapped shifts in the size of high, middle, and low-income neighborhoods in Canadian urban centers over the last four decades. His findings show that Canada's middle class is shrinking. In Vancouver, the middle class has decreased from 77% in 1970 to just 52% in 2015. In a November 15th feature for online news publication The Tyee, Urban Issues reporter Christopher Chung expanded on Holkansky's findings. Christopher graphed neighborhood changes in Metro Vancouver by ethnocultural grouping, education, immigration, and commute method in order to find out who exactly makes up Vancouver's low, middle, and high-income neighborhoods. One of the things he discovered is that despite Vancouver's multicultural identity and diverse ethnic makeup, white people make up 67% of high-income neighborhoods. I reached Christopher by phone yesterday, and we discussed this and other findings. Let's take a listen.
So my name is Christopher Chung, and I'm a reporter at the Tyee, and I report on urban issues.
And you recently wrote an article, it was published on November 15th, which uses the latest census data to show how neighborhoods in Metro Vancouver have changed over the years, and it focuses on shifts in low, middle, and high-income neighborhoods. So in terms of wealth concentration in Metro Vancouver from the 80s to now, what broad trends did you find by region?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, what got me started on this, everybody who lives in a city, they see, houses being bought up, condo projects going up, or, businesses closing, things like that, and that's very much, on the ground. So when I first came across the research of this University of Toronto professor, David Holkansky, I was really taken aback because it really shows you how low, middle, and high-income neighborhoods have changed over time. So what he did was map it all out back from 1980, and so you can see where these three groupings of neighborhoods or census tracts are in the region. So yeah, low income is red, and then high income is blue, and then middle income is like this kind of a white, off-white color. And then so as you see it happen over time from 1980 to today with the latest census, you can see how we used to have a lot of poverty around the inner city, and the rest of the region is mostly middle income. But then over time, you see, you know, people with more money slowly moving back to that inner city, and then low-income neighborhoods slowly coming out into the region, so creeping into Burnaby, creeping into Richmond, and Surrey in particular. And if we count the census tracts, you actually see polarization. So what that means is there are more high-income neighborhoods and more low-income neighborhoods and less middle-income neighborhoods.
So did your reporting find that this polarization and the case of an increase in wealthy families was more due to folks immigrating to Metro Vancouver who are wealthy or to wealthy people getting wealthier? Did your reporting have a chance to dig into that at all?
I didn't really, but the professor did. To note, like, this isn't about necessarily wealthy individuals, but neighborhoods' average incomes. So that means there are more richer areas rather than richer people. And so, there are many reasons, you know, provincial and federal tax cuts, especially in social assistance, rising housing costs, and we used to have a lot of pretty well-paid manufacturing jobs, and those have slowly disappeared in the past three decades.
Right. You graphed ethnocultural segregation as well in Metro Vancouver, and you did so based on our 2016 census data. Can you tell me what you found?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the map data, I didn't crunch that one by myself, but when I saw that about a year ago, I was really curious who actually lived in those low, middle, and high-income neighborhoods. And so I was able to get some of that data and break it down by ethnicity. And what I found is that there are a lot more people of color or people who identified as visible minorities on the census in low-income neighborhoods. So I'm looking at it right now, and in low-income neighborhoods, 27% of the people there identify as white, which leaves about three-quarters identifying as visible minorities, and that's completely different in high-income neighborhoods, where you see 67% of people identifying as white and the remaining third as visible minorities.
Right. And it's interesting because, you know, you only have data to this ethnic breakup of the population from 2016. But if you had information available over time, do you have a sense of what shifts in ethnocultural segregation we would have seen since the 80s, for example?
That's a tough question. I would assume that it would be quite similar to what I mentioned about incomes, where it's a bit more even, so less polarized. So I would think that if we were to go back, that the spread would be a little bit more mixed compared to now how it is.
Right. Yeah. I suppose we're just speculating, but I was just curious
mm-hmm.
your thoughts.
Mm-hmm.
How much did education, the amount a person was educated, whether they'd finished high school, gone to university, or done like a technical trade, how much did that seem to impact what class status a neighborhood had?
Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, if you think about low-income neighborhoods, you would probably assume that most of the people there might not have post-secondary education. But if you look at the data, it's actually quite surprising that half of them do have a university degree or some sort of college or technical certificate or training. So yeah, that's half. And then in high-income neighborhoods, it's of course it's a bit more. It's two-thirds. But it just goes to show that just because somebody might be living in a poor area, it doesn't mean that they might not have the same educational attainment. And so if we're thinking about what I did with data was look at where immigrants live as well, and there are a lot of immigrants in low-income neighborhoods. So the prof suggested that it's quite likely that a lot of people have moved here and have higher education from somewhere else. but after coming to Canada, they might not be able to practice whatever it was that they were educated in.
And then when it comes to how much more time people spend commuting to work, whether they're from a lower income or higher income neighborhood, how did you find that compared?
Mm-hmm. So people in low income neighborhoods do have longer commutes. It's not too much of a contrast compared to high income neighborhoods, but if you're looking at the mode of how they get to work, so whether they're driving or transit, it does say a lot about where they live, because a lot of these low income neighborhoods are in more suburban areas, and people who have more money, they're able to choose where they live. And really today, everybody wants to live close to transit or near downtown or in a more urban area. And so we see that low-income neighborhoods, people still do drive a lot because they live in very car-dependent places, and also that they don't really have as high levels of walking or biking. I was speaking with a friend of mine, and they thought, I would have thought that people who didn't have as much money would be biking more, but actually people who are living in wealthier areas are biking more. So I think that just goes to show that the design and layout of where people live is really important, because, you could be living in an area with lots of cul-de-sacs, very, very far from the bus, or very, very far from your place of work, and you don't really have many options. And so, you're forced to own a car, or you're forced to take transit.
Right. So sort of healthier options are often a luxury for working people.
Mm-hmm. It certainly is, yeah. And if you're thinking about the people who might be taking the train in low-income neighborhoods, their commute times would be longer, and they're also having to pay more usually to cross, the zone boundary on the TransLink network.
Yeah, and one of the biggest takeaways from this piece I found was that Metro Vancouver has become more polarized, as we talked about. There's a shrinking middle class, but in particular that this shrinking middle class is more predominant in suburban areas of Metro Vancouver. So we're sort of alluding to why that is now, but could you maybe talk a little bit more about that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I mean, if we're thinking about a city like in the post-war area, if you think about who's middle income, who's middle class, like that, that idea is very much tied to, living in the suburbs and having a family and owning that car. And so when a lot of those areas began to have a boom, middle-income people tended to be the ones who were able to live there. And so that's why we have cities like Burnaby, Richmond, and Surrey that used to be kind of like bedroom communities of Vancouver, having a lot of these families that chose that lifestyle. But of course, over time, middle class people tended to, they didn't really enjoy the suburbs very much. They wanted to live in, they wanted urban amenities and things like that. And so we see that a lot of those areas are really what's left over. And it's usually people with less money now who have to live in those areas just because they don't have as much choice. And the prof I spoke to, he said, he's really, really great three words to understand this, and that's money buys choice. And so the people that don't have enough money, they really just have whatever areas that are left over, and those areas tend to be less convenient and more of a burden for them.
Right. And transportation, as you mentioned, public transportation in suburban areas isn't as great as well. So with folks who have to live in the suburbs but come into the city of Vancouver to work are also, as we mentioned, driving more. And yeah, why also are so many workers from the suburbs coming into Vancouver to work rather than working in the cities they live in, be it Burnaby, Coquitlam, or whatever?
It just could be where the jobs are, depending on what they work in. But I think there's this idea that some people think that having cheaper housing is the most important thing, but then they don't really think about the trade-offs in terms of time or how much money they might be putting in to, to basically raise their own car, because that's really expensive. So I think, just because you are able to have cheaper housing doesn't necessarily mean that you're not paying a large chunk of your income to be able to work where you are, if you're living in a farther flung place.
Right, absolutely, especially buying gas as well.
Mm-hmm.
Right, so just to leave things off, I'm curious how this research that David Hulkansky of the University of Toronto, that you based some of your reporting on, how the research he did on how Vancouver's neighborhood shifts in wealth compared to other cities in Canada.
Mm-hmm. It's actually very similar. If you're interested, you can just go to, what's the website here? If you just Google neighborhood change, so it's neighborhoodchange.ca, you'll be able to see how different cities in Canada have been mapped out. And the trends are all extremely similar. It's the same with, many more higher income areas, many more lower income areas, and that shrinking middle.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Yeah. So overall in Canada, we just have a shrinking middle class.
Mm-hmm.
And why that is a more complex and longer conversation that we won't get into here. Thank you so much for talking to me and breaking down this article, Chris. It's really great, and we'll direct listeners to it so they can check out the data mapping you did, because it's really something that communicates well visually.
Mm-hmm. Thanks. And yeah, I think that a lot of people are, they're paying attention to what happens in Vancouver proper, but not really what's happening in the suburbs. Breaking it down like this, I think, is quite eye-opening.
Absolutely, I agree. So thank you so much for your time.
Okay, thanks for having me.
Thanks, Chris. Thank you for listening. That was an interview with Christopher Chung, Urban Issues reporter with the Taiyi. If you want to read his reporting, this article that we were discussing, which was published on November 15th, and check out the graphs he made, which really communicate very well visually, despite us turning this into an audio piece. You can do so by checking out the story online at the Taiyi. The article is titled "By the Numbers: Metro Vancouver's Increasing Inequality and Division." And we're just going to take a really short break and be back with more local news on CITR 101.9 FM. Stay tuned.
Teens aged out of foster care without a permanent family.
Adoption is not just for babies. Teens need families too. Only 24 teens in BC were adopted last year.
November is Adoption Awareness Month. To find out more about adopting a teen, contact the Adoptive Families Association of BC. Call 1-877-ADOPT-07 or visit us at bcadopt.com.
Discorder Magazine has been supporting local music for over 30 years. Thanks to the long-term support of the Rickshaw Theater, Discorder lives. Your favorite bands are playing at the Rickshaw Theater. Check out their calendar just behind the cover of Discorder Magazine or at rickshawtheater.com.
And we're back. This is Democracy Watch on CITR 101.9 FM. It's time for proportional representation.
Party.
BC's third referendum on electoral reform is coming to an end, and with only a week for your vote to arrive at Elections BC. The question is, do we stick with the current first-past-the-post system or switch to a proportional representation? If one were to shorten it, it would be pro-rep or prep.
Oh,
I don't know. In total, there are four options on the table. The first is to keep the status quo, aka FPTC. If you want to shake things up a bit, you have three proportional representation options to choose from. They are dual member proportional, mixed member proportional, and rural urban proportional. We could explain the nitty-gritty details of those systems, but I think that'll make for bad radio.
Yes.
So feel free to look them up in the attachments in your voting packages or on Elections BC website, elections.bc.ca, which is pretty straightforward. Today, we'll have a conversation with people on both sides of the debate. But first, we're going to start today's show with an interview with Andrew Watson from Elections BC.
Good evening, Andrew. How many ballots? Sorry, my bad. How many ballots has Elections BC received so far?
Yeah, so as of yesterday morning, so November 21st, we'd received about 810,000 completed referendum voting packages. That represents about 25% of the registered voters in British Columbia.
Okay, and what should voters who have not received their voting packages yet, what can they do?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so there's a key deadline coming up for eligible voters who haven't yet received a voting package. That's November 23rd. That's the last day to register and request a voting package.
So that's tomorrow?
That is tomorrow, yeah, Friday, November 23rd. There's a few ways that voters can do that. They can call Elections BC at 1-800-661-8683. And that number will be available from 8 a.m. tomorrow until midnight. So they can call us and request one through that channel. They can also visit our website at elections.bc.ca. And there's also referendum service offices open in the Lower Mainland and Service BC centers elsewhere in British Columbia.
And what is the final deadline for voters to submit their completed ballots?
Yeah, so we would encourage voters to submit their completed ballots as soon as possible. The deadline as it stands right now for Elections BC to receive completed voting packages is November 30th. But we've been monitoring the job action at Canada Post that's been underway for several weeks now. And we are actively considering extending that deadline and anticipate making a decision in that regard soon. Notwithstanding that, you know, whether or not there's an extension, we just encourage voters to return their ballot as soon as they can.
Great. So you just mentioned that Canada Post workers are currently engaged in rolling strikes across the country. How has the strike impacted the referendum so far?
So we have seen rotating strikes in British Columbia, and we are seeing a delay in mail service in some parts of the province. We're getting daily updates from Canada Post and are in regular communication with them to try and determine that full impact, you know, as part of considering whether or not to extend deadlines. Our basis for an extension would be, you know, if a voter was prevented from participating through no fault of their own. So as that November 30th deadline approaches, that'll be a key consideration for us.
Okay, and once all the completed ballots are received and the deadline's passed, how long will it take to tally the votes?
So it will be a matter of weeks following the close of voting. A mail-in referendum is different than, say, a provincial election in which we typically have initial results on election night. For a mail-based referendum, all of the counting is done centrally in Victoria, and there are fewer staff involved than in a provincial election. It does take some time. Certainly reporting the results as soon as we're able to the public is a priority for us, but it will be a matter of weeks following the close of voting.
All right. Thank you very much, Andrew.
Okay. My pleasure. Thanks, Ryan. Have a great day.
Take care.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Okay. So that was Andrew Watson from Elections BC.
Yeah, and we should say the reporter who conducted these interviews is Ryan Patrick Jones, or RPJ, a News Collective comrade, mostly involved last year, but popped in to do some reporting for us. So thanks to Ryan. Christina, you edited this interview down a bit. Why?
He was very technical about how votes get counted in Victoria, which for democracy buffs, you know, it's very interesting. But for those of us who tend to skip over the details of anything,
like
then
letter
it's
opening.
Yeah, or what are those consent forms for using any kind of app? Those billion page. It felt a little bit like that, so I thought I would skip over those.
Probably smart.
Yeah.
It's an inherently boring topic.
Yes, but
we're going to be honest with you.
He does bring up a good point that we only have until tomorrow to actually receive our ballots if we have not already had those come to us.
Correct. If you did not receive your referendum ballot in the mail, you have until tomorrow, Friday, November 23rd at 8 from midnight, to get a voting package. You can do so by visiting electionsbc.ca/OVR or by calling Elections BC, their numbers online, or by going in person to a referendum service office or Service BC center. And you can also find these locations online. So did all of us mail in our referendums? I did.
I'm afraid I did not.
Lyndon Wong, why not?
Because I have yet to get a BC ID.
Oh, why is that?
I haven't been living in Canada for the past 10 years, so, you know, that's why.
Yeah, and also because your age is young? You are young. How old are you? 17?
I'm 18.
You're 18? So you would have just been able to vote this year?
Yeah.
Cool. Sweet. Okay, so mm-hmm. yeah. You probably won't be able to vote then in this
yeah.
particular referendum.
Probably next yeah. year.
Cool. For you, Christina?
I have it currently filled out and sitting on my desk because I am bad at getting shit done.
Yeah.
But I've also pressured everybody I know to vote for this thing, which is a little bit hypocritical, except I'm going to vote for
yeah.
sure.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. I'm going to vote. But yeah, I've actually had to literally fill things out for my siblings who are completely uninterested, but they signed their own form, so it's not a forgery.
Okay, good.
Just
okay.
so we're
on
clear.
Air right
so
now.
It's not a crime.
We're
so
live
you're not
right
admitting
now.
To a crime. So
yes.
That's good.
Okay. Okay. Let's. All right. Well, maybe we should move on to the next segment here. What do we have, Christina?
So up next, we have Bill Tillman. He's a political columnist and former NDP strategist. He is also the director of the No BC Proportional Representation Society. Here he is representing the no side in the referendum.
Good evening.
Why do you think First Past the Post is superior to proportional representation?
Well, we've had First Past the Post here in British Columbia for 145 or of our 147 years as a province. It's stable, it's successful, and it's very simple to understand for voters.
So one of the main arguments against First Past the Post is that it inflates the number of seats large parties receive and excludes minority parties from the legislature. What would you say to counter that?
Well, in the first place, we have to look at the fundamental way in which First Past the Post is different from proportional representation. Every party that's formed government in British Columbia's history has had won a majority of the seats in the legislature, which is geographic ridings. All of those MLAs who were sent to Victoria were the choice of their riding, of the people in their community who said that's the best person to go to Victoria, and the party that got the most seats or parties in the case of the current government is the one that forms power. That is a fundamental difference with proportional representation, where you are looking at having a mathematical formula where whatever the popular vote might be, roughly speaking, is equivalent to the number of seats, not necessarily the number of seats won in geographic ridings.
So aren't you worried about a tyranny of the majority under First Past the Post?
No, not at all, because each government has a majority support of all the communities that make up our province.
Okay, so let's turn to the campaign now. How has the no side encouraged voters throughout the campaign?
Well, we've run a fairly significant advertising campaign in both traditional advertising mediums like TV, radio, and print, and also a significant amount of social media advertising on Facebook, Instagram, Google, Twitter, etc. And so we've been just pushing our messages out, different messages on different themes of the campaign.
What has the response been from voters?
Well, we're going to find out in December, I guess, but we feel very confident that we're getting a message across to our voters in a way that will lead us to win this referendum.
Some people on the no side have called for an extension of the deadline to receive ballots mm-hmm. beyond November 30th. Why is that necessary?
Well, we've had throughout this period of balloting rotating strikes by CUPW, the union representing workers at Canada Post, pardon me, and that has delayed delivery of mail and both delivery of ballots to voters and as well as their ability to get the ballots back. And we have also had a very abysmally low turnout to date, and we're at less than half of the turnout, for example, of 2011 mail ballot on the harmonized sales tax. So we think that it would be a good idea for Elections BC to extend it and make sure people get every chance to vote.
And how long do you think they should extend it for?
We leave it up to Elections BC to decide that, but I think realistically it would either be 1 week or 2 weeks, presuming that the postal dispute is actually resolved at that point. But at the moment, we think a one-week extension would be a good idea, period.
How would low turnout affect the legitimacy of the result?
Well, we're talking about not changing, not electing a government, but actually changing the rules on how we elect government. So we believe that, number one, there should have been a threshold, probably 40 to 50% range, for voter participation in order to make it valid. In Prince Edward Island, they had a referendum on electoral systems, and the premier rejected it because it had mid-30% range turnout. We also think if we look at the Canadian Constitution, it has several requirements in there for having a strong majority or strong consensus report. And in the last two referenda on the single transferable vote proportional representation system, you had to have 60% of the vote in favor and a majority, 60% of all ridings in the province voting a majority in favor. So all of those have been thrown out. We have no threshold for participation in this election. and it's 50% plus one.
And who do you blame for that?
Well, the NDP government and the Green Party brought this in, so they have to bear responsibility for it.
All right. Do you have any final words for those who might not have voted yet?
Well, I would urge them to take a good hard look at everything, all the information available. There's a lot of neutral information in Elections BC, but I think they should think about, do you want to take a chance with two of the three proportional representation systems proposed, never having been tried anywhere in the world, and the third used in a very small number of countries, versus a system that's worked very well for us over a long period of time.
All right. Well, thanks very much, Bill.
My pleasure.
Okay, so that was Bill Thielman from the No BC Proportional Representation Society. It's interesting that he used to work with the NDP, because I think the NDP would benefit greatly from this electoral reform. What do you think, Alex?
Well, we certainly know that the Greens would benefit from it. The NDP is pushing for it because they promised the Greens they would do that in order to have their support to keep confidence in the provincial government. But it is it's very interesting. I agree that Bill Thielman is a former NDP strategist. So it's, I guess, not that cut and dry. I haven't looked into it in depth, though, the different ridings and the vote breakdown to see exactly how, if we had one of these PR systems, and keep in mind there's three, so the results would be different depending on which one, how it would affect the NDP's strength to govern the province.
Hmm.
I don't know.
Yeah.
How about you, Lyndon?
I agree. Like, it would probably benefit the Greens a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So.
Yeah. That's one thing we can say for sure. But yeah, it's interesting to look at, because this this referendum on our electoral system has very much been framed in a partisan way, right? That if you are a provincial Liberal, you are against it. And if you are an NDP voter or a Green voter, you're probably in favor of it. But in fact, it's not really a partisan issue. If we look at other governments in the world that have PR, they're not necessarily really left-leaning countries. I mean, Australia certainly isn't. It's center-right. Parties that get power are parties on all sides of the spectrum, right? I don't know. It seems pretty balanced, but it's certainly been framed as a more left-leaning electoral system here in BC.
Yeah, and I think that is why people are kind of associating proportional representation with the youth.
They absolutely are, and it's absolutely a generational divide.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. And so are you saying young people are more inclined to vote for the NDP?
Perhaps, because they feel like they can find alignment with parties that would be better served in a proportional representation system.
Right, yeah. Yeah, though I don't know about the demographic of NDP voters and whether there are more young people who vote for the NDP than the Liberals. I'm not sure we can say that, unless you are aware.
Yeah, I mean, as we have said before, for sure the Greens would gain more seats.
That we know one thing for sure here at Democracy Watch. We don't know a lot.
The Greens are going
to win. We don't know a lot, but... all right, so now we have another person that Ryan interviewed. Right. Who is that, Christina?
So for our next interview, we have Simca Marshall, Field Director for Vote PR BC.
Hmm.
It's the main lobby group in favor of proportional representation. Let's hear what she has to say.
Hello, Simca.
Hi there.
Why do you think we should change how we vote?
I think we should change our system, because the current system that we have is outdated, and a system of proportional representation is just a better way of voting. It's a way to make every vote count, which also means that it's a way to engage a larger number of people who traditionally, you know, would feel that they're not represented in the system, like young people or students or in folks, you know, from Indigenous communities.
What would proportional representation offer voters that the current system does not?
There's a number of things that are a number of reasons why pro-rep would be a better system. You know, one of them is that political parties will be forced to work together on issues like very real issues that affect British Columbians. It also would make, you know, government more accountable to their voters. It would just be a way to it's a more fair and democratic system where voters are actually represented and have a seat at the table when it comes to, you know, who forms government.
What is the guarantee that political parties would actually work together and not and that it wouldn't lead to paralysis?
I mean, proportional representation is a system that is used in many, many other countries around the world where they're able to get work done. And, you know, we're seeing, it is a system that, you know, you don't have a choice. You have to work together in order to get stuff done.
Some worry that a proportional representation system would allow extremist candidates and extremist parties into the legislature. Is this something that we would have to live with under a PR system?
I think that this is something that, you know, there are things that are put in place, like a minimum threshold of votes that are required for a party to have any sort of representation in the system. That threshold is 5%. And I think that is kind of a safety measure to ensure that, you know, those more, you know, the extremist parties wouldn't be able to get access in these systems. And so I think that the threat of extremism is real under any electoral system. It's not any more real or any worse under a system like proportional representation.
What has the Yes side been doing to get out the vote?
The Yes side has been working with a number of different partners. You know, we are working with labor unions and nonprofits, and particularly on campuses, which is what my focus has been. I've been basically working on the campus program that we've developed to mobilize voters and just act as the folks there to, you know, give those voters as much information as they need in order to put their mail or their ballot in the mailbox. And so with our campus program, we've been at 13 different campuses all around the province in every region of the province, just having peers talking to peers about the referendum and giving them as much information as they need so that we can see, you know, young people mobilizing and getting to the polls or the mailbox, so to speak.
So there seems to be a bit of a generational divide, with young people more open to considering a change and older voters somewhat happy with the status quo. How do you think this is playing out in the referendum?
Yeah, I think that this is really interesting because, you know, there have been polls and there's research that's been done that shows that proportional representation is very favorable to the younger demographic, particularly the 18 to 24-year-olds, which is a really important voting demographic for us. Government, like the policies that a provincial government makes, affects so many aspects of a young person's life when it comes to, like, education. You know, young people are graduating with tons and tons of student debt when they finish their degree, or there's a lot of young people that are just living paycheck to paycheck when it comes to, you know, just trying to get by and paying rent. I think that this really shows, like, just how important it is for this generation, because our generation is facing like a multitude of unique issues like that of affordability than any other generation. So it makes sense that this is something that, you know, they would be feeling really passionate about to mobilize and to change our system, because it's clear that the current system isn't working for young people.
So let's talk about the design of the referendum. Do you think a mail-in ballot was an effective way of engaging voters in the process?
I think that a mail-in ballot has shown its unique challenges, particularly for students. And I'm sorry, I'm talking a lot about students because that's been my main portfolio during this campaign. But like for students, for example, it has introduced a ton of challenges because of how transient in nature students are. And so, you know, it's been a couple extra steps in order to get people to do that action of casting their ballot. And so, yeah.
Okay. Are you concerned about voter participation?
Yeah. I mean, I think that we have seen a bit of a slow uptake in the campaign so far. However, I am seeing that there's more and more people casting their ballots. I think there was a lot of people waiting kind of last minute, and I think we're going to see a pretty big rush. And, you know, my conversations with people on the ground, people have their ballots, and, you know, they've been waiting for more information to be able to submit their ballot. And so I think that we're going to be seeing a bit of a rush in this last little bit of time that we have here.
So what's your message to last-minute voters?
My message is, you know, just to vote for proportional representation, because it's a system that is going to work for marginalized communities and for working class families in British Columbia.
All right. Thank you very much.
Cool. Thank you so much.
Okay. That was Simca Marshall, Field Director for Vote PR BC. Which is a group obviously in favor of proportional representation. What did you guys all think about, especially the conversation about whether the mail-in ballot method is a good or bad thing for voter turnout?
I think that, well, it's more convenient if you are going to remember to put it in or if you check your mailbox, which I don't really. Mm-hmm. But I knew that this was coming, so I actually did.
Mm.
I think it will possibly suppress voter turnout because people are just going to not even know what it is. I had a friend who told me that he just threw it out because he didn't know what it was about. And people usually think that, you know, things that aren't what they're expecting, they think that it's junk mail.
Yeah, people mostly get junk mail. What is the amount that has been mailed in so far? Is it 18%?
I think the Elections BC guy said it was about 25%.
25%?
Not including the the ballots that are still in transit.
Right. And of course, there's still a lot of time. There's a week, but a lot of people leave things to last minute, right? Like on voting day.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to look up the number right now. But yeah, I mean, I think that the system is very archaic and mailing something in, you have to, it seems to me that it is less effective and engaging as a voting method than like if there were voting stations. That being said, like, Lyndon, you brought up a good point that does it even matter because people are very apathetic regardless.
Yeah,
I don't
like,
know.
Voting really hasn't been improving, like turnout.
In Canada.
Yeah, it's been decreasing pretty steadily. So I think also it's another thing where, like, if you don't care about the election, if you don't care about these topics, then you're probably not going to vote for it.
Mm-hmm.
And mail-in ballots do not contribute to a higher turnout in that way or garner any interest whatsoever.
Yeah, I suppose so. And perhaps, yeah, with young people who don't use the mail anymore,
yeah, and
really?
Who are also quite a bit more likely to have moved in the past few years. So it's hard to keep a voter roll for them.
Absolutely. That's a really good point. There's a number of people I know who don't have their ballots, didn't get their voting package in the mail because they moved. I mean, I move all the time. Like since, you know, in my 20s in Vancouver, I moved, you know, every year, every couple years. So like you're saying, young people are more transient. For example, my voting package was actually at my previous place that I lived like 6 months ago, 8 months ago. So my landlord had to text me and I actually went and picked it up. But
Yeah, not everybody would do that.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Especially young people who can't afford to drive anywhere and they have to take the bus, which is a hassle.
Yeah, my old place is like a block from my new place, so that was really convenient for me. Keeping time in mind, I feel like we should probably move on a bit here. So we're just going to take a really short break, and then we actually have more PR. This next segment is going to be really fun. It's a conversation that debunks the myths that PR leads to a rise in radical fringe parties. So you're listening to Democracy Watch on CITR 101.9 FM. Stay tuned. We'll be back after this short break.
Stop. Ugh. Everybody dance, dance. What, you don't like to dance? Everybody dance.
Ugh.
Everybody.
God, this is awful.
Isn't there anything? Anything? Anything?
Listening to the radio these days can be distressing. Fortunately, here at CITR, our programmers choose the music that they play, so our charts reflect what people actually listen to. To find out what's really topping the charts, pick up a copy of Discorder magazine or check us out online at citr.ca. Unless, of course, you'd rather keep listening to the chart-topping single, Everybody Dance.
What, you don't like to dance? Everybody dance. Everybody dance. Everybody dance, dance. What, you don't like to dance?
Last year, over 650 BC teens aged out of foster care without a permanent family.
Adoption is not just for babies. Teens need families too. Only 24 teens in BC were adopted last year.
November is Adoption Awareness Month. To find out more about adopting a teen, contact the Adoptive Families Association of BC. Call 1-877-ADOPT-07 or visit us at bcadopt.com.
Hello, we're back. I'm Lyndon Wong, and you're listening to Democracy Watch on CITR 101.9 FM. We have another piece on proportional representation to conclude today's show. News Collective member G. Rosales and a friend recorded a conversation which debunks the myth that proportional representation leads to a rise in radical fringe parties. Let's listen to what they had to say about it.
Hello, my name is Guilherme Rosales.
And my name is Josh Taffel.
And we are both students in the Master of Public Policy and Global Affairs program here at the University of British Columbia. Today we're going to talk about proportional representation. Specifically, we're going to explore two main issues. The first one is, what is proportional representation going to look like once it comes about? What are some maybe implications? The next issue we're going to consider is kind of myth-busting this idea that we're seeing propagated on social media, on the internet, and that is this idea that proportional representation is a vanguard and platform for extremist parties. I don't know about you, Josh, but I kind of think that's BS, but we'll get to that. So to begin with, what do you think are some kind of things we might see in a PR system for Canada?
Yeah, so just to clarify for everyone, we've got a referendum with a question on the ballot asking us basically to choose between three different types. So we've got dual member, proportional, mixed member proportional, and rural urban. So yeah, it depends on which one of those gets chosen, obviously. But I think some of the implications for any of those, I think we discussed this earlier today, was basically we're going to be seeing a shift in kind of the landscape of the political parties.
Yeah, so Max Cameron mentioned on a News 1130 clip a couple of weeks ago, I was driving and just listening, and he said, you know, we can expect multiple election cycles, 4 to 5 election cycles before things are kind of in a sense of flow. So, I mean, we're looking at close to 20 years after if we do elect this new electoral system for BC before things even out. But I think you're right. We're going to see a huge shakeup in politics. I'm personally thinking what we're going to see is more coalition-style governments, forced cooperation initially. I think it's going to be clunky. We're going to have a lot of issues that get to the legislature and then kind of get stopped because there's a lot of disagreement and people are going to, I think our MLAs are going to realize they have to cooperate more amongst each other. Think in a PR system, party politics will die?
Well, no, I don't think it will die exactly, but it definitely will change, especially the way it is right now in BC. I know, like, for example, BC Liberals and the BC NDP, too, for that matter, they're quite, you know, big tent parties, right? So they're already a coalition of people who have widely different beliefs. So, for example, BC Liberals, there's a lot of people who would vote conservative in a federal election, but also a lot of people who are, you know, more towards the center left. So we'll definitely see a shakeup. I'm not sure how exactly it's going to play out, but certainly some of those parties will probably split off into smaller parties. Yeah, it's going to be interesting for sure.
Yeah, I mean, another thing I think that'll be really positive for everyone besides the fact that all of us will be proportionally represented appropriately, so you know, the majority of us will actually be represented finally, is this idea that because it's shaking up politics, I think we're going to see an interesting struggle in terms of special interest groups and lobbyists. They no longer, if the parties kind of fracture or the government's more coalition style, they're not going to be able to, you know, donate large campaign fundings to just one party because things will be more split up. It's going to be harder for them in a way to lobby or send money a certain way because now they have to, instead of, you know, one main avenue, one main big party tent stream, there's going to be all these little rivulets of, you know, interests and people they have to convince.
Yeah, it's not going to be like, you know, we've got one party that's the corporate party and one party that's the union party kind of thing. It's going to be radically different, I think.
So I personally think that's great, and hopefully mm-hmm. it'll reinvigorate our kind of democracy. So let's kind of jump ahead to this idea that PR is a platform for extremist parties. Okay, so first of all, that's kind of the main idea. There's no real solid arguments except for the fact that because it allows, you know, a lower threshold of people to kind of get into legislature, as we're more proportionally represented, we're going to see these fringe parties enter politics. And this is a big worry for a lot of people. Personally, I think, you know, like, if people are worried about extremist parties in this system, why aren't they worried about it now? Coups happen, you know, we look at history and coup d'etats happen in all types of countries and all types of systems. First past the post is just as vulnerable to, you know, a coup by an extremist party or military faction, just as PR is. So, you know, why are people worried about PR? It almost seems like they're trying to purposely demonize it when the reality is it can happen in any electoral system. It can happen in any society. It depends kind of on a various confluence of issues. So personally, I don't think it's a very strong argument because if they're worried about it in the future, they should be worried about it now, especially with mm-hmm. the rise of kind of authoritarianism and the backsliding of modern democracies that we're seeing occur.
Mm-hmm. No, that's a good point. And you also have to look at it like if there are those kind of fringe ideas that most people don't agree with, those ideas still exist now, right? And they're probably even present within the political party. Mm-hmm. that we have. The difference is that they're a bit moderated by the majority of people in those parties. Yeah. And I doubt we'll see much of a change if we go to proportional representation. If you have first of all, we have the 5% amount of vote that you need to get a seat. But second of all, if you have like a fringe party with 5% of the vote, they're not going to be holding the majority of power in parliament, right? So you're going to have a coalition of parties that will moderate their views also. It's not going to be like a fringe party will hold the majority of power.
Yeah, and this kind of goes back to the PR talk we both went to a couple months ago mm-hmm. at the Liu Institute. One of the panelists' discussions points was this exact point. And what he said was really striking. I forget his name, the professor, but he mentioned, you know, we currently already have fringe groups. Most of us don't even know what these fringe groups are. For instance, one of them is the Marxist-Leninist Party. Mm. Yet when we think about this, we got to consider, do we want in our current system to keep these people festering in the shadows or in a PR system, bring them into the light, into the front stage where we know who they are, we know what they're talking about. Mm. And in the democratic process, we might be able to even show them and convince them that what they're thinking is founded on very shaky underlying assumptions and that ultimately they don't have any strong basis for their ideas or their claims. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that's kind of one of the benefits of having a PR system is getting these people out front and center stage so we know what they're about instead of in this system where there are fringe groups, but most of us don't even know who they are, where they are, what they're talking about. And in my mind, you know, framed in these terms, that's kind of scary. Now is scary compared to the future of having PR and being like, we can see you, we know you, now let's talk.
Yeah, no, that's perfect. And you have to realize like when you, it's almost worse when you shut them out of society because then you don't get that dialogue.
Yeah, and then things get worse, right? They fester, right? They kind of brood and, you know, we have, and then there's incidents that occur. So going back to any other kind of thoughts on PR, do you have anything else, Josh, that you kind of wanted to delve into in terms of kind of what we might expect to see or maybe kind of thoughts you had about PR in general?
Yeah, not really at this time. I mean, it's just interesting to me just how things are going to play out. Mm-hmm. We've got that whole two campaign cycles, and then we're going to have another vote to see if we want to keep the system that we have if it does happen to go through. So I'm interested. Yeah, it's an interesting experiment, I guess.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, we do have other nations to look to that have done PR before, New Zealand and Australia, for example.
Of course,
I know some of our provinces have experimented with this even.
Yep. And even BC was, you know, we haven't always been first past the post.
Exactly. So yeah, I mean, for the listeners out there, just, you know, get educated. I hope this was somewhat helpful, at least in trying to debunk this myth you're seeing on your Instagram and Twitter feeds that, you know, PR is for extremist parties. Frankly, it's not. You're going to get extremist parties at any point in time, and at any point in time, any society is vulnerable to attack by people who want to take power. That's just history. So that's our little talk on PR and exploring these issues. We might do another one after the referendum goes through, and maybe depending on what happens, we'll analyze the situation. And once again, we are from the School of Public Policy and Global Affairs at UBC, so stay tuned for more thrilling content on various political and public policy issues. Do you have any last comments, Josh?
Thanks for listening, folks, and we'll see you next time.
All right. We're back. Thanks for listening to our coverage on proportional representation. You just heard a little conversation between News Collective member Guy Rosales and his friend there in a class on proportional representation. They're students here at UBC. So if you have not yet voted on our referendum on proportional representation, please be sure to mail in your ballot. You have until November 30th. And if you haven't received your voting package, you have until tomorrow at midnight to get it. So get it. You've been listening to Democracy Watch on CITR 101.9 FM. I think our plan with our podcast version of ourselves is to segue our election pop-up podcast, Seeking Office, into At Large, which is a post-election podcast. So
everybody listen, because it's great, even
thanks,
though
Christina.
There isn't a single episode up yet.
Well, there is, actually.
Oh, really?
Well, we released one under, like, Seeking Office. It still says Seeking Office. It's still the Seeking Office feed in your podcast apps. But I think we're going to be communicating with our audience, you, hopefully, and transitioning into At Large. So maybe we'll have, like, the logo for Seeking Office morphing like a transformer. Like, you know those books that we used to have? You're too young. You know them?
Yeah, Animorphs.
Animorphs, yeah. Yes. We'll have, like, an Animorph Facebook cover of, like, Seeking Office turning into At Large.
I'm not as young as Lyndon, but I have no idea what you're talking
about. Oh, my goodness. Okay,
can we
well.
Talk about Sailor Moon instead?
Well, but yeah, so basically keep subscribed to Seeking Office and it might become a different podcast. So,
yeah.
Cool.
And also, did you know that once politicians are elected into office, they turn into monsters? That's why you have to listen to At Large to see how they transform.
Oh,
I tied it back into your Animorphs thing, right?
That's good.
Yeah.
That was really good.
Yeah.
Yeah, I like it. And my friend Kunsung did some art that I will show all of you in a second. I would show you listeners, but although radio
the
is
right.
the most visual medium, we cannot.
That's a lie.
I know.
A picture is still worth 1,000 words.
Is it? Well, yeah. So anyway, keep listening to our podcast. Thanks for tuning in to Democracy Watch on CITR 101.9 FM. If you want to check out a sick workshop on advanced interviewing for audio, Sam Fenn of the wonderful podcast Cited is doing a workshop tonight at 6:30. So wherever you are, come here to UBC, to our Point Grey campus in the Student Union Building or NEST to room 2131, and you can have a free workshop on podcasting with an award-winning podcaster and journalist, Sam Fenn. So again, the topic is advanced interviewing, so come check it out if you want.
And even if you don't.
And even if you don't. Okay, we're actually done now. I always do a lot of false ends. Okay, thanks so much for listening. This is Democracy Watch on CITR 101.9 FM. Stay tuned for more programming. Flashback with Alec Christensen is next.